welcome to the Astra Economic Week in Review. My name is John Eckstein. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of Astra Investment Management. I'm joined today by my friend and partner, Rob Stein. Rob, hello.
Hello, John. Happy New Year. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year to all of our Astra podcast listeners. We're recording this on Friday, January 7th, 2022, a few hours after the latest payroll report. And as we do on Payroll Fridays, Rob and I will talk about what we see there. This being the first Astra podcast of the month, we'll give a little bit of state of play where we see the economy now and what we are looking for in 2022. And let's jump right in. So actually, this number is a lot like last month's number to me, a disappointing payroll number, which is made up for by a substantial household number. And it's also worth mentioning that this is before any sort of Omicron stuff came into play. The end of the reference week was the 11th. It came out a little early, the 11th of December. So that's before we had the latest shenanigans. So the raw numbers, non-farm payrolls came in at 199, expecting 450. There's a little bit of excitement today because Biden announced that he is going to be making a statement about the payroll number, and the president gets the payroll number a day early. That's a good reason to get that job, I guess, if you still have to trade bond futures.
But who would know what to do these days with the number?
Right, exactly. It's not totally clear. Anyway, so people are like, oh, he knows something, but then he didn't. Revision, positive two-month revision of 141. Uh-huh. Unemployment rate down from 4.2 to 3.9. That's a substantial
back to pre-pandemic levels, right?
Back to pre-pandemic levels, yes. And the we're not back to pre-pandemic levels would be in things like the prime age labor force participation rate.
Yes.
But that is within spitting distance, honestly. Like, it's much closer. Mm-hmm. That's the thing I've been following the most closely. And that is probably only, 1% below where it was. It should be 80 and it's 79 or something. So that's going in the right direction. And so the other thing, if you look at the level, so there's two main surveys. One that talks to firm, one that talks to people. They combine them and they ask slightly different things. But when you adjust the household survey to match the same concepts as the establishment survey, there's been a relatively big gap over the last year and a half, and that gap is closing quickly.
Right? So it's interesting you bring that up.
I think that's the story, is that I think the establishment survey is more reflective of the current rate of growth, and the household survey was underestimating job growth and is now catching up.
Okay, so I agree that they eventually revert, and they tell different things at different times. You know, as you were reading off the numbers, the shortcut is the entire quarter seems to be less acceleration than the previous quarters. So we can pick apart the month and the revisions and so on. But it looks like it's still a good trend. It's maybe surprising where the unemployment rate has gotten to for the variety of reasons of entering and leaving the workforce. And the acceleration has got a full quarter of showing that the acceleration has slowed, but certainly nothing that would concern us about the economy. As far as the two surveys, I'm writing about this in my Outlook report, and it's something we've talked about, but not sure how fully there's buy-in. But a lot of people who've left the workforce have gone into business for themselves, whether they're single member LLCs or they're cobbling together a few different things that instead of working at your local McDonald's, and that doesn't get picked up on right away, if at all. And so the household survey might be accounting for that differently than the establishment survey. When people are taking a survey question right now, 6% of the workforce is saying they're self-employed or single member LLCs, and that's up from 4.5 or 5 a year and a half ago. And I think that might explain some of the growth in the economy that's not connected directly with what we're seeing in employment trends.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that is interesting. There's a real step up. So basically,
interesting, but needs a lot more investigation to be able to make it into economic analysis at this point. That's what I think.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting from a long-term standpoint. So if you look at the number of self-employed, unincorporated self-employed workers, that number is actually fairly steady for the 10 years ending 2019, about yeah. right around like 9.5 million. And now
right.
jumped up to more like 10.2 million, right?
Right. But what I find interesting is if you go all the way back to like in the 80s when M&A and all that cool Gordon Gekko greed is good stuff, we've been on a decline for a long time. And this is the first kind of period where if you look at it graphically, looks like it's a new direction for this. And it may have an implication of what the economy and what recoveries are going to look like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important point.
And, but who knows?
Right. And so, yeah, so if I said that the number was stable, right, at 9.5 million, that's a shrinking share of the population of the employment as the labor force grew over the substantially over those 10 years. And now going back up a little bit for the first time. Other oddball things, the number of people employed but not at work is fairly high. Are unemployed and not at work due to illness, their own illness is fairly high. And that'll be higher next month. Oh, so here's something interesting I saw today. Last year, total revisions was 1.1 million jobs out of the 6.5 million created over the previous 12 months. So let's say 6.5 million jobs is a lot of jobs, right, for a year. Like, that's really good. Like, good for us.
Right.
But like, those revisions tend to cancel out over time. And there's kind of nothing like this in the history, right? So like, uh-huh. like 20% of the total job growth, well, one was sort of underreported, right, in the media. Like, people, it shows you that we're still trying to adjust our stats to the current state of play.
Well, so I think that's an important point. And we've mentioned it probably only every time we talk about this number over the last few months, that the numbers are so big, 6.5 million, ginormous, million and change correction, and even 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 estimates for payroll numbers. It's hard to get that right in this environment. Once upon a time, I'm repeating myself from a few podcasts ago, you were off by 10 grand and you were shunned in the economic community. You know, you thought 140, the consensus was 148, it came in at 168, shame, shame on you. I think these numbers are so large. And the way that we aggregate the data, and with people being sick and COVID and new types of ways of reporting and new software systems, it's not surprising that we're, I mean, maybe 20% off is more than I would expect, but it's not overly surprising that these numbers are having very large corrections.
Yeah.
Something good for Aster, the way we aggregate, the way we look. it doesn't hurt as much.
So, you know, what's just kind of interesting is that the flows from employment to unemployment are very much in the low end of that number. I mean, there's always sort of a constant churn, but we're at the very low end of that number as people are not getting unemployed. I guess, and that's consistent with what we hear about anecdotally with the labor force.
Right. This is going to be interesting data for our kids who are going to become economists to use as a sample size when looking at modeling moving forward, I think.
Yeah, this and the day the crude went negative.
And that, right, which will be in the same time period. And I hope it doesn't get written off as, you know, some sort of anomaly. Let's not count it, because there are lessons and things that are happening here that will be valuable.
One more thing before we leave the details of the payroll number, and that is wages were quite strong in this number. And again, like, focus in the service sector. So like, average hourly earnings up 0.6% month on month. Like, that's a lot, right? That's a lot. Mm-hmm. And that number doesn't adjust for the composition of the labor force. So if you added a bunch of high paying jobs, you can't distinguish that number whether we added a bunch of high paying jobs or whether low paying jobs got better paid, right? So that's why people like to wait for the employment compensation index. But still, it's very suggestive that we still have very solid, we have some solid wage growth, maybe even keeping up with inflation. So I think we will turn to where we see the economy exactly today. We usually say so, the economy in a nutshell, and then talk a little bit about our outlook. And so for today, I see my base case is continued strong economic growth, inflation high but moderating, the pandemic gradually becoming less of an issue, and the Fed removing stimulus, beginning to move stimulus in March and bringing stimulus to neutral or slightly tight over the next, let's say, 18 months. That's my base case.
I agree. I think growth will continue. I think there's a lot of gasoline left in this engine. As far as the Fed, that's my wild card. I think they're going to do a lot more talking than action. And this is based on nothing theory. But I believe that they are going to start and then stop. And then I agree with your 18-month scenario. I think that they're going to get nervous when they start actually doing some things that are tightening beyond just the cursory comments and bond purchase things. I think they're going to have to learn to not let the child cry and let him stay up later. I think they get spooked. And I think that happens somewhere at the end of the second quarter. And then they resume tightening, getting themselves to neutral 18 months or even sooner. I also think inflation is going to stick around. It's going to be a lot more persistent. But I believe that inflation is going to be confusing because I think it's going to be so uneven, imbalanced, and impacting very different parts of the employment sector. And I don't want to go too far into the woods here. I'm writing about it, but I think that's what's going to be different about inflation this time. It's not just meat prices are going up and everybody at the supermarket is feeling the pinch. And you've already pointed out to wages are already kind of keeping up with it, but that's uneven. Like some wages are accelerating above it, some are not. And I think that we're going to see that in the type of inflation that we have. And I think that's going to lead to the performance of various different sectors and asset classes having a very significant diversion from each other. In an inflationary environment, you just sort of buy stuff, right? And sell bonds. And I think it's going to be a little bit more of a weird inflation environment.
I guess it's impossible because, I mean, there's always a lot of unknowns, but we've got the things that we have, we're trying to, that are special this time. Number one is the pandemic. Is this the last big variant or is the Omega variant coming that's going to really change our behavior? Like nobody knows. Like more of stuff is coming, but how bad is it going to be? Like, who knows?
Right.
And then so the next thing would be like, so what extent do spending patterns go back to 2019 spending patterns and how long does that take? Right. So we're still spending much more on goods and much less on services than we did 2 years ago. And does that go back to where it was? Does it not make it quite back to where it was? Is that if it goes back to where it was, does it take 6 months, 24 months? That's a big unknown that I'm worrying about too.
Agreed. And I mean, we all have opinions on it. I don't think we go back. I think we get used to behaviors of consuming.
Are we like permanently taking fewer vacations, eating out less?
So here, again, kind of echoing back, I think that the aggregate amount of how much people are eating out is probably going to be the same, if not greater. But the participation of that is what's going to be different. So I think that there's a set of people who are now, wow, I cook or I'm saving money by doing this, and that pulled from the restaurant goers. And I think there's other people who are now transitioning to the other side of that. My mom's 86. I see a pattern shift clearly amongst her and her friends. Me and my friends, maybe, you know, you and how you and your family. So I think that that's going to be the dynamic change. And I think that it's going to be the higher end restaurants. I'm not talking about 5-star fancy restaurants, but I'm talking about from fast food to whatever the next level up is, where I see
casual, I think, is the next level up.
Let's get right. So that's what
fast,
I see.
Fast casual, right?
Like Apple. So I'm getting in fast casual. I'm getting into the weeds because I'm agreeing with
right,
you.
But I'm going to say like, I think people are going to go back to spending more. I think those spending habits are going to go back to more on services and less on goods, right? There's only so many pool tables you can have. And like people ended up like not spending that much on stuff and spending more on experiences for a reason. And that reason's going to reassert itself, right? Especially to the extent that people have more money in their pockets. And so I think, and then once people are able to scale up, like once staffing isn't a constraint anymore, I see that direction going, right? More people going back to spending more on services and less on goods.
Yeah, I understand. I think that you're going to get, again, you know, the amount of money that's going to be spent on goods, I think, stays constant. Instead of maybe, you know, 300,000 people buying pool tables, it'll be 200,000, but they'll be buying nicer, bigger pool tables. So I think we're going to get a shift from inflation and from where people are going to be spending. I'm seeing people spend on things that I know they're going to continue that you wouldn't have thought would have been the case. Same thing with vacations. I'm agreeing that we're going to see a little bit of a reversion, but I think it's not going to be because a behavioral shift as much as you're saying a rebound. I'm saying that you're going to have different participants that are going to make the outcomes look the same, the amounts look the same, but you're going to have a smaller set of people buying pool tables. They're just going to be spending more on them.
Right. Maybe. I can see that happening.
We'll see.
And so I guess my other big question is, one of my interpretations of 2021 is that a lot of people at the low wage end of the labor force got a move up. They got a move up by changing jobs from like a crappy service sector job to a less crappy service sector job. And they went from $15 an hour to $20 an hour. Right. And so like, how long does that little bit of power that labor has right now to set terms, right? It's much more of a seller's market in the labor market than a buyer's market at the low end, apparently. How long does that last for? Is that sort of done already? Is that continue and even build in strength in 2022? Do you have any opinions on that? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I do. In fact, I could get really philosophical because I think it's a semi-permanent change, the relationship between labor, capital, and resources. Resources are going through the roof from inflation. Capital is getting overly rewarded, particularly the risk capital that you kind of got for free because you were in the right place at the right time in the stimulus lane. And labor, for the first time, was able to say, you know, tough luck, Charlie. I'm not doing that unless you overpay me. And so what I see happening is the appreciation of labor and wages, it's a cold slap in the face. We're now realizing, wow, they should be making a couple bucks more an hour for that. And wages are inelastic on the downside. Once people feel a little bit of control or power or a say, that doesn't go away so quickly, particularly when it's a large group. So I think that that's here. It might not be moving like this, but I think we are in a social change of labor and capital's relationship.
Yeah, there's actually a whole debate going on in some places about like, what do you call people at the low end of the wage force, right? Like a low wage doesn't necessarily get you the right place, because imagine like a PhD student who's waiting tables. They're earning a low wage, but they're very highly skilled. And on the other hand, like there's definitely jobs like being a line order cook, right? Which is very intense and does require a lot of skill, but those skills are relatively easily acquired, and they don't compensate as well as some other is being, you know, an option.
But I think that that's a huge, and we should make sure we don't go too far off, but a huge change that's happening. So I think there's high skilled jobs that our technology is going to disintermediate. And I'll name one right off the top, pilot. So I think that you're going to be able to have a lower skilled pilot because the computers are going to be able to do so much of that. I think certain types of surgeries, where you needed like the skilled of most skilled doctor, where you're going to have somebody that's not even a skilled, maybe not even a doctor, but very proficient at the machine that does whatever this is. And so I think that moved that all the way down to the line order cook. And so I think you're going to get this change of skill sets that are doing higher skilled things than they would have a few years ago.
That would be consistent with labor, right? So when labor gets more expensive, people add more capital, right? And so that's the endless cycle. So that would be consistent with that story where we say, okay, the low end of the labor force, you just can't pay anything less than $28 an hour. And so like there are people who are investing money in burger flipping robots or whatever.
Right. I mean, you ever go get an x-ray and like the lady who took it is looking at it and she's like got a smirk on her face, but she can't tell you till the doctor comes, but she knows what's in there.
Right. What's she doing all day? She's watching things.
Yes. But she's not a doctor, but you know, she might even see it better than the doctor.
So I had those two things to talk about. There's a bunch of other things you could think about too. I guess the biggest would be, so it seems to be a Chinese property market lending constriction. Will that lead to a hard landing? Probably not. They're pretty careful about that, but who knows? It's tricky. Mm. Did you have any other sort of big picture outlook things you want to bring up?
Yeah.
I know you're writing an outlook for the blog, so just the highlights.
I think interest rates are going to play the biggest part of how markets and the economy respond this year. And you could have good growth and not a great stock market. I agree with your growth outlook. But I think as interest rates, they're going to be very volatile. I think the stock market's going to have more volatility. I think that there's going to be a reversion of the difference between the S&P and the NASDAQ. That's my main kind of theme this year. And I'm not saying NASDAQ gets hammered and the S&P doesn't. I just think that their performance is going to be much more in line than it's been. And it's going to have to do with interest rates and how the market treats interest rates. The other part of my theme is inflation. I don't believe inflation is going to level off just yet. And that's going to be need to factor into how that impacts growth. So interest rates affect stocks, infecting the NASDAQ more than the S&P. Inflation is something that we need to be more mindful of and prepare for in our asset allocation decisions, because it's going to keep accelerating.
Interesting. Well, we get new inflation numbers next week, which inflation is kind of the new payroll, is what we're all waiting for. So the 12th, you get your CPI, and probably Nick and I will be back to talk about CPI in a week. And I think we will leave it there. So if you want more economic data, you can check out the Aster website, asterim.com. That's asterinvestmentmanagement.com. You can download the Aster Research app, or you can reach out to your Aster sales representative. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, John. Cheers.
To learn more about Aster Investment Management's research and strategies, please visit us on the web at www.asterim.com or stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and our app is also available on the App Store and Google Play. Thank you. Aster Investment Management, LLC, is a SEC-registered investment advisor. All information contained herein is for informational purposes only. This is not a solicitation to offer investment advice or services in any state where to do so would be unlawful. Analysis and research are provided for informational purposes only, not for trading or investing purposes. All opinions expressed are as of the date of publication and subject to change. They are not intended as investment recommendations.